everyone, or I guess good afternoon, everyone. A little after 1 o'clock, Friday, February 10th. Judiciary has come to order. Present is Representative Lynn, Representative Keller, Representative Holmes, Chair Gatto. We have a few other members who are apparently a little bit late. First, housekeeping. Pay attention. Pay attention. Turn them off. What I'd like to say is if you don't turn them off and they go off, you have to give them to me. Just turn them off. So that's the housekeeping. We have five previously scheduled bills that we'll take up. First, I want to take up House Bill 255, reading or typing messages while driving. We covered so much of it yesterday. I think we're going to have an amendment. It's a very easy, simple, straightforward amendment defining a word. And
Max had the amendment?
Yeah, but we can move it without it if you want.
If I have it.
I've got it. Okay. It's on our desks.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move amendment number one, which is identified as X.1.
And it simply says...
Would you like to object?
No, I don't want to object. I like the amendment.
Like
anybody want to object? We'll describe it.
Just to describe it.
Without objection, amendment number one is adopted. Oh, I'm sorry, we also have a new CS, don't we?
No, do we need to move the new CS?
Yes. So we've just added an amendment to something we don't have.
All right, so
we need to go a little bit backwards and get CS, which is called backslash X, like X-ray. Representative Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt CS for House Bill number 255, Judiciary 27-LS1165 backslash X as our working document.
Object.
There is an objection from Representative Keller.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that CS only incorporates the two amendments that we passed in the on Wednesday. So there's no new.
Remove my objection.
Objection is removed. With no further objections, we have in front of us CS for House Bill 255, Judiciary, version X, like X-ray. And now we can entertain amendment number one. Representative Grunberg, did you want to offer amendment number one, which is titled X.1 up in the corner?
Yeah, do the members have, do the members have Pam Finley's memorandum also? Yeah, okay. I'll offer amendment one. If somebody will object, I'll explain it.
I'll object for discussion.
Thank you. Amendment number one just clarifies the language here because, as Ms. Findlay, the reviser, said, it doesn't make any sense the way it's written. And a lot of people looked at it, and some were confused, some were not. I'm confused about whether I was confused. But this clears up the confusion. And I understand that the prime sponsor is okay as long as we move the bill, right?
And for people listening, amendment number one goes to page 3, line 13, following the word vehicle. And insert, right after the word vehicle, whether removable or permanently installed. So we're looking at equipment that's installed in a police cruiser. It could be, lots of things in a cruiser might be installed but easily removed again. Just hit a couple latches, and we wanted to make that clear. It also goes down to page 3, lines 18 to 20, where we will delete something like quotation marks and add the words installed means equipment.
We're deleting it.
Okay, we're deleting installed means equipment in an emergency vehicle, whether permanent or removable.
Mr. Chairman, we're basically moving the definition up into the body and taking it out of the definition.
Got it. Okay. So I think it's probably time to either, we're done with the amendment, we need to vote on it, or see if the
I ask that objection be removed.
I remove my objection.
Any other objections? Okay, amendment number one is adopted, brings us back to the main body of the bill, which we dealt with extensively a couple of days ago. And this is a pretty small amendment, doesn't change the details in the bill at all. Unless there's an...
Just to put on the record, Mr. Chair, I was going to work on Amendment Number 2, and I'd like to thank James Waldo and my staff, Miles Brook, and Representative Holmes and Representative Pruitt, and decided not to offer that.
Got it. Okay, we closed public testimony. I'm going to open it, reopen it. We have one request. Mary Miller, are you online? Mary Miller. Say that again.
She is online.
She's just not hearing us?
Is she on mute, maybe?
Maybe she's on mute.
Yeah, Mary Miller, you might be on mute because we cannot hear you if you are online.
Yes, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Go ahead and go ahead with your testimony. First spell your name for us.
Sure, it's Mary Miller, M-I-L-L-E-R.
And go ahead with your testimony.
Okay, as the Transportation Director for Central Council of Klinkit-Mahaida Indian Tribes of Alaska, I'd like to go on record for supporting House Bill 255 in the intent to provide greater safety for the public with regard to driving and driver retention, and would just simply like to let our position be known that we're in support of whatever will improve public safety on our roadways.
Okay, Mary, are you speaking to represent only yourself, or are you representing a larger group?
I am the Transportation Director for Central Council of Klinkit-Mahaida, and as in my official capacity, I'm supporting the bill.
Thank you very much. With that, I will close public testimony. Committee members, any comments?
Yep, Mr. Chair.
Representative Keller.
I'm going to object to moving the bill, and I want to explain now. it's a very broad. You know, to if you, I call your attention to page 2, line 7, a person who is reading or typing a text message, and, you know, and so forth. Reading a text message is a such a minuscule action to make it illegal. I just can't go there. And there's such a wide range of circumstances that could be involved in potentially making a law here that will make somebody be a lawbreaker. It could be a really nice day, and it could be no traffic. It could be up on the summit going to Fairbanks with, you know, with a huge wide road, and it's gone too far. And where do you stop? It's a slippery slope. We're back here because of a very rational attempt to stop DVDs and watching movies going down the road that makes complete sense. But the problem is, where do you stop? You know, do you start outlaw eating, adjusting the radio, instrumentation on your vehicle, GPS? So I'm going to be objecting, but I just wanted to give a quick explain why. Thanks.
Okay.
Representative Thank you very much. I concur with much of what my colleague Wes Keller says. I have some concerns with it. Well, first of all, I don't understand why anybody would text anyway when you can talk on a cell phone. I never have understood that. If anybody wants to contact me, please call me and talk to me. Do not text me, because I probably won't want answers. So that said, you know, how can this be enforced? How does a police officer know if you're texting or not? I mean, it's almost one of the enforceable feel-good kind of bills. So I have some serious concerns, you know, about this. I think, though, it deserves to be heard by the wider audience, in the House, and I'll make up my mind at that time. Well, I vote yes or no on the House floor, but I do share the concerns that you enunciated.
Okay. Representative Pruitt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Obviously, I've had expressed some concerns in the past, and I actually believe that what Representative Keller said is important. It's how are we We don't want to make a bunch of people lawbreakers. I think really the best thing that this piece of legislation can do for us is I don't think we're going to be able to have, it's going to be very difficult for the police officers to prove that someone was texting. We haven't moved into a situation where they can't use their cell phones, so it's going to be very tough for a police officer to be able to do that. What we might do, though, is make someone think twice about it, because if they get into an accident for texting, then it's really where this kind of consequence steps in. And I think that's the one reason why I'm willing to let it go forward, is because I don't think we're going to end up having cell phone police with this. And that would concern me. I don't want our, there's a lot of things for our cops to do out there. I don't want them looking to see if people are using their cell phones. But if someone does cause an accident, and I've heard many stories, and I've encountered people where you see they're weaving and they're going up on the curbs, and because they're texting, if they cause an accident, then this is really kind of the way for us to say, we got you on that. You were beyond just reckless driving. There's another way for us to come at them and say, bring the book down on them, I guess you say. So I think that's why I'll be supporting this this piece of legislation.
Representative Grunberg?
Mr. Chair, I'd ask leave of your committee. I didn't realize Mr. Svobodny was here in the audience. Could I ask him one question? I think it's important. I'm sorry.
Sure, but it's got to be on the record. Mr. Svobodny, would you come forward? Question from Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. Mr. Svobodny, we've had testimony and a fiscal note statement by the head of the Public Defender Agency, and he attributed it to you in saying that certain areas of the state, the current text messaging bill, AS-2835-161, is not being enforced. Is that correct?
Through the chair, my name is Rick Svobodny, and I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. It is correct that I've had discussions with the head of the Public Defender Agency to indicate that there were, in which I indicated that there were communities that where the cases weren't being prosecuted. And frankly, I didn't intend to testify here today, but I did put a call into the Kenai office to around noon to ask if they weren't prosecuting, and I was not able to speak to the DA. I spoke to an assistant who believed that in some instances there were. I've been told in Fairbanks it depends upon whether you get one of the judges who says it's the law that you can't text, or you get the other judge who says no. I think that, I don't think Mr. Steiner was overstating what I said, but I think in retrospect it needed to be nuanced a little bit. I don't think that it is correct to say the police aren't enforcing the law. I think it is correct to say that depending upon who the judges are, the state's not going forward with the prosecution.
May I follow up, please? This is extremely important. We've had some conversation. It had been my impression that that the Department of Law was taking the position they should be prosecuted, and if a judge actually dismissed the case, that an immediate appeal would be taken. Or a notice of appeal filed, because in the Adams case, there is already a case on file before the Court of Appeals. It's more difficult to restart a case if you don't prosecute it from the word go. You got to try to find witnesses and stuff, but if you have it ready to go, then it is certainly ready to be prosecuted. And I would hope, Mr. Svobodny, through the chair, that your people around the state would have a uniform policy to go ahead and prosecute, and if a judge dismisses the case, to file a notice of appeal so that the public knows that it's the Department of Law's position that the law already covers this, so that people don't start texting again in the middle of the stream here, and so the law is upheld as we think it should be, And that, by the way, is even more reason to pass the bill because of Section 1, the purposes section, which clarifies for the Court of Appeals that this is and has been our intent right along, and we are simply reaffirming that. And I would ask on the record if Mr. Svobodny could either give affirmance to my request or respond in writing with that. This is extremely important, Mr. Chair, if Mr. Svobodny could respond on that.
Mr. Chair, if you want me to respond.
I think we're outside of passing the bill here. I think that's a conversation that is interesting, but my goal is get the bill passed. It has an immediate effective date. When that happens, I think that clarifies the law for judges, police officers, and violators.
Would you permit him to answer the question?
All right, go ahead.
Thank you.
I'll respond in writing, but as Representative Groomberg knows, that the state doesn't, it's an extraordinary circumstance where the state gets to appeal. We can petition the Court of Appeals, and they can decide whether or not they want to hear the matter. But unlike the defense, the state has no right of appeal.
I thought it was to test, if I may, I thought the state had the right of appeal to test the sufficiency of the information or indictment, and if a case is tossed out, is that not within the state's right to appeal that?
It depends. It depends, no. It depends on how each case on its merits. No, it doesn't mean that we have it. There are circumstances where, for example, if a grand... Sorry, Mr. Chairman, it's a long answer, and I'll give that to you in writing, too. When we
please, because I am concerned on something like this, if there's no right to appeal. That would mean that there could be an erroneous legal decision, in this case by a magistrate, and no redress. So I please respond maybe to the committee, and the committee could distribute that.
Be happy to.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Holmes, would you...
Mr. Chairman, I move CS for House Bill number 255, Judiciary Version X, as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
I object.
There is an objection. Susan, we're going to need to take the roll.
Representative Keller?
No.
Representative Pruitt?
Yes.
Representative Thompson, not present. Representative Groomberg?
Yes.
Representative Holmes?
Yes.
Representative Lynn?
Yes.
Representative Gatto?
Yes.
5 yes, 1 no.
Okay. Let's take a... So the bill passes from committee. Let's take a brief intermission so we can get the paperwork signed, and then we'll resume right after that. Judiciary's back on the record. Next, we have House Bill 299, an act allowing appropriations to the Civil Legal Services Fund taken from court filing fees, sponsored by Representative Steve Thompson. He is not here, but we have someone else to testify on his behalf. So we need you to put yourself on the record. If the name is complicated, you'll need to spell it for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, I am Thomas Studler, and I serve on this Representative Thompson's staff.
Give you spell your last name.
Studler.
Got it. Okay. Give us your testimony.
I would like to thank the committee for hearing this bill today, House Bill 299, an act allowing appropriations to the Civil Legal Services Fund from court filing fees, provides a valuable service to Alaskans who are in need of legal services that otherwise would be unavailable to them. This bill is designed to help fund civil legal services for low-income Alaskans. House Bill 299 will provide a mechanism for funding the Alaska Legal Services Corporation, ALSC, by giving direction to the legislature to appropriate up to 25% of filing fees paid to the Alaska court system during the previous fiscal year into the Civil Legal Services Fund. The Alaska Legal Services Corporation was established in 1966 to address the civil legal aid needs of low-income Alaskans. ALSC is not a state agency, but is instead a nonprofit charitable 501c3 whose funding comes from a variety of state, federal, and private sources. Over the last several years, ALSC funding has dwindled from $4.2 million as of 1987 to less than $3.1 million as of 2010. While it struggles to serve a growing number of poverty-level applicants, appropriations from the state of Alaska that were once as high as $1.2 million in fiscal year 1984 are currently at $350,000. House Bill 299 aims to correct this lack of funding and helps to ensure civil legal representation for Alaska's most needy population. Last year alone, 2,541 Alaskans below the 125% of Alaska poverty ceiling received services from Alaska Legal Services. Over 550 cases involving domestic violence and over 600 senior citizens received services from the Alaska Legal Services. Over 40% of all clients assisted by the Alaska Legal Services reside in our rural communities. Alaska Legal Services were only able to meet the need of 81% of all their qualified applicants last year due to the funding limitations. With that, sir, I know there are a number of people to offer testimony on House Bill 299 today. Thank you.
Okay. First question I have for you is that it says up to 25%, so it could be 5%. Who makes the decision of how much percent is used?
The legislature would.
So it has to come before the body through the committee process? And
it would actually come through that process, yes, sir. It would come through the appropriations process.
Okay. Members, got it, yeah. Members of the committee, questions?
I got
Representative Keller?
Just help me understand, and you know, this might be for the Department of Law, but the WID is not kind of focus money, dedicate money for potentially criminal defense, in other words, it goes from civil to criminal here, right? I mean, if you're talking punitive damages, that would be ultimately the source of the money, right? And then if it's used, you know, for defense in a criminal judgment, I don't even know if that matters. I'm hoping to hear from the Department of Law or just give me some, if there are any policy ramifications here that I'm blind to that somebody knows, and I just wonder if that had been part of the discussion or not.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, my understanding is that the court filing fees are from civil cases only because there are no fees applied in criminal cases at all, right. if that is indeed the question. So there's no mixing there. It's just the municipal and superior court fees for civil cases that would be brought into the fund for this particular matter. And as far as them defending somebody in a criminal matter, I believe they are prohibited from doing that. And I have the director of Alaska Civil Services who's going to be testifying who can better qualified to answer that question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. He will probably help me clarify my question, too. Thank you.
She.
I apologize. The other one.
I'm sorry.
Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify that, of course, right now the 25% is coming from, or is going into the general fund, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Well, their funding comes from the general fund, and the court filing fees go into the general fund. Yes, sir.
Okay, so basically it's kind of a policy call of do we want certain monies going to the general fund and be applied to whatever we want, or are we okay with X amount being redirected and not having the opportunity to, I guess you'd say, appropriate that for streets or whatever.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, my understanding is that this year would allow the legislature to appropriate up to 25% of those filing fees. And that, my understanding is that the filing fees works as a guideline or a baseline on what the court cases have been seen in civil process.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Why has this not been in place before? What is the need to put it in place at this point in time? Is it
Representative Pruitt? I don't have the answer to that.
Was it dwindling revenues?
It is dwindling revenues, sir. Like I said earlier, they were funded at $1.2 million, and now it's $350,000 from the state. And the people that they provide services to cannot afford these services. So,
okay. And this will bring it up to how much if you got the full 25%?
Mr. Chairman, if it Based on last year's figures from the Alaska court system, the courts received $2,666,900 in filing fees alone. So if you were to calculate that at the maximum that the legislature could give, it would be $666,000 maximum.
There's still not the possibility, because we're still, you just mentioned we're giving them $350,000 a year currently, right? We went from 1.2 to 3.
That was last year.
So this would be...
Yes, that was last year.
So I would expect this 660 would probably potentially be above and beyond the 350, or are we just, I mean... Will it be acceptable to the individuals involved in the services fund to just receive this money and not receive whatever appropriation we may choose to do year by year, which could actually be, according to, as you said, it could have been 1.2 in the past. It could be higher than even this. Are they okay with just receiving the 25%? Or will we see them asking for more money?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I think that question would probably be better asked to the president of Alaska Legal Services.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Nicole Nelson, Alaska Legal Services, are you online?
Yes, I am here, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me?
Quite well. Go ahead and give your testimony. You probably heard the question from Representative Pruitt about whether this is in addition to or instead of.
I did, and first off, I wanted to thank you for having this hearing, and again, apologize for not being present today. I had a scheduling conflict and had tried to show up for the Wednesday hearing, and so I apologize to the committee for not being present. So to answer Mr. Representative Pruitt's question, if we were to get this appropriation up to the maximum, which would be 25% of court system filing fees, is $670,000 at this point, that would represent about a 20% increase in our overall budget and would allow us to serve an additional, about additional 500 families we project per year if all of their funding sources stayed flat. So in an ideal world, I mean, one of the things that's important to know is that even though we are serving 2,540 families last year on their critical legal needs, we were forced to turn away an equal number. And so this bill would hopefully enable us to serve more people. And so, you know, if we added this money on top of, if the legislature were to appropriate this on top of our appropriation, the 350 appropriation, we still would be, you know, underfunded and not be able to completely meet the needs of the low-income population that we are trying to serve. So I mean, the intent is to increase the availability of funds to meet these needs. And there's, even with this additional money, there still would be a great unmet need. So our hope would be that we would keep our regular appropriation, and then on a year-by-year basis, the legislature could look to this vehicle to see what the needs were for that year in addition, if that answers Representative Pruitt's question.
Just so we get our arms around this, this 25% would be in addition to your prior funding?
Yes.
And the prior funding has diminished, and you're hopeful that this will bring it back up to, do you have an idea of, based on statistics, what the grand total would be?
Well, yes. So, based on statistics, if I can get the numbers right, right now, the Alaska Supreme Court Access to Justice Task Force indicated, and this was again in 2001, recommended that Alaska Legal Services budget be at what would now be $7.5 million. And our overall total budget, coming from all different sources, including private fundraising and local financial support, is about half that. It's about $3.5 million. And so so this would, even with this additional amount of money, we would still be far underfunded, far below the actual funding recommendation as made in the Alaska Supreme Court Task Force recommendations.
Okay, so what you're saying is we have a Alaska Legal Services budget is $7.5 million, but you're not meeting that?
That is the recommended. $7.5 million was the recommended budget adjusted for inflation of the Alaska Supreme Court Access to Justice Task Force. Right now, our total budget stands at about $3.5 million.
What year was the $7.5 million recommended?
What year? That was in, the recommendation was in 2001.
Okay. That's helpful. Appreciate that. Have you concluded your testimony?
Well, I would like to just talk about, a couple of things. I wanted to explain a little bit more about the work that we do. And, you know, in the last year alone, we have been on the forefront of fighting the epidemic of domestic violence that's plaguing the state, serving over 550 families. 78% of those were children in the household, and that makes us by far the largest provider of these services in Alaska. We also helped over 600 seniors, protecting them from physical and financial abuse and assisting them with their end-of-life issues. We also helped 300 disabled individuals gain access to health care coverage and Social Security benefits they so desperately needed. We helped 350 families avoid homelessness and also helped veterans obtain their needed benefits. And our staff, in total, again, we represented over 2,500 families in the last year and served countless more through our website and those who attended our self-help clinics. Our staff is paid well below the market rate for attorneys. A staff working for, starting out in Anchorage, working for our law firm, is going to make about $38,000 per year, whereas an attorney general working for the state or the PD's office starts out at about $68,000 per year. We also rely on a volunteer pool of attorneys who donate their time to help us stretch our dollars and a volunteer board. And again, we enjoy widespread community and bipartisan support, and we are very grateful for that. When in each of the 11 communities where we retain an office, we have local financial contributions. But again, in the last year alone, we still had to turn away hundreds of families who sought assistance with such compelling needs. And we were turning away, again, about one family for everyone we assisted. And these were folks who had really compelling needs. They were seeking protection from abuse. They were faced with losing their homes. And they could not access their, you know, needed medical care or benefits. And it's not because their cases lacked merit or that there weren't laws to protect them. They were turned away because we lacked the staff and resources to help. And I think this is particularly, you know, tragic because we know we can help. And I wanted to give one example of that. We know we look back over the last five-year period, and specifically in the domestic relations area, we had a 96% success rate in achieving our clients the result that they needed in that case. So we actually know when we get into a case, we really can make a difference. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that our client base is growing every year. And like we've talked about before, our funding just has not kept pace. We have, there are an estimated 88,000 low-income Alaskans. And last year we received over 3,500 inquiries and nearly 3,000 new applications for help. And this doesn't include the many more who did not apply because they knew how limited our resources are. And so I would just say that as, you know, as a community, we need to find a way to bridge the gap between those who have access to the civil justice system and those who are able to achieve it. And I believe that HB 299 is part of that solution. And I would thank you for your time.
Okay, Ms. Nelson, thank you for your time. Is Rick Allen on the line? Public advocacy, Rick Allen?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Hi, this is Rick Allen. I'm director of the Office of Public Advocacy. Mr. Chairman, I basically wanted to be available for any questions, but I did want to clarify one item, and that is my fiscal note discusses the fiscal impact, of course, that we believe that that this could have on our agency. And, you know, there's an issue as to whether the Office of Public Advocacy really needs to be on the other side of these cases with Alaska Legal Services. But that aside, that doesn't mean that the Office of Public Advocacy doesn't believe that a strong Alaska Legal Services is what's in the best interest of the people of Alaska. I certainly do believe that. I think that Alaska Legal Services does a lot of good for a lot of vulnerable people in our state, and I believe they are the appropriate agency to handle these needs. So I just wanted to say that, Mr. Chairman, and then if the committee has any questions, I'd be happy to answer. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Allen. Doug Gardner is there for questions. Quinlan Steiner? Quinlan, are you on able to hear us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Quinlan Steiner with the Public Defender. I wasn't planning on testifying on this bill. It doesn't really have any for the Public Defender Agency.
That's fine. It's just that there was a Y for yes opposite your name, so I went there. Monica Looney, are you available online?
Yes, I am.
Well, go ahead and give us your testimony. And think I'm going to spell the name L-O-O-N-Y, Monica.
L-O-O-N-Y, Monica, M-O-N-I-C-A. Can I go ahead?
Yeah, please do.
Oh, okay. My name is Monica Looney. I'm the mother of one son. Yeah, his name is Kenneth. And my ex-husband committed domestic violence against me. He had a violent history and a lengthy history of drug abuse. After we separated, he continued to be violent against me and not leave me alone. I was very, very scared. I tried to start the legal process myself, but it was very overwhelming. His family hired a very high-end attorney and knew that I had no money and would not be able to hire an attorney for myself, and pretty much figured I would be representing myself. I sought out assistance from Alaska Legal Services, and my attorney there helped me to understand my rights and how to protect myself and my son. They assisted me with getting a divorce with custody of my son, full custody, with a maximum protection of visitation with his father and a long-term restraining order. Also, to help me not be responsible for the mounting medical bills that he incurred during our marriage, which was a very short marriage. I can't really explain or express how I feel about how they've helped me to feel safe, to have my son safe again. And every year, I send them a Christmas card with his picture on it so that they can see every year how he's grown and how he's safe and happy. And I can never repay what they've done for us. And I just wanted to send my support out. And if there's any way to help more families, I truly believe that they saved both our lives. And there's no doubt in my mind that they saved both our lives.
So Monica,
and I just wanted everyone to know that.
Monica, you did access Alaska Legal Services?
Yes, I did.
How long have they been serving you?
I believe since 2010. I felt so lucky that they took my case, because I know that they are so overwhelmed. I did not expect to get chosen, but when I did, I just can't tell you how I felt that at least I had some help with them. And actually, I think that just in case, because of I've also the stalking order, just in case, I think Maggie has kept her name on my as my attorney, just in case I may need protection in the future, which seems like might be the case, and that my son might need protection in the future as well.
Well, thank you for your testimony, Monica. We really do appreciate it, and I'm sure you're one of a great many people that has dealt with domestic violence, and that's why this organization is here. I'm going to go next.
I'm so grateful for it.
Thank you. Go to Michelle Sharp. Michelle, are you online?
Yes, sir, I am.
Go ahead and give us your testimony, if you would.
Yes, sir. I'm a mother of three children, ages 12, 9, and 4. My ex-husband was physically abusive to me. As a result of one of his assaults, he was convicted. Even after the physical violence stopped, he continued to control me emotionally and financially and regularly threatened that he would take the kids away from me. At that time, I sought out assistance from Alaska Legal Services in May of 2009, and my attorney there helped me get protective orders, gain custody of my children, and helped me work on gaining financial stability for my family by giving a child support order and making certain that I wasn't responsible for all the debt that was accrued during my marriage. Having assistance from Alaska Legal Services made moving and staying out of this abusive situation possible for me and helped me protect my children from witnessing a life of violence. I personally do not know what we would have done, as the lady testified just before me, without their services and the help that they brought to me and my three children. I too am very grateful and blessed that they were there and able to take on the case to help us and help the family. And I too want to do anything that I can do to show my gratitude and appreciation for their services and just stress the importance of their service to my family and many others out there that desperately need this service.
Okay, listen, once again, I'm really saddened when I hear about individual cases of domestic violence. And you should know that the Alaska State Legislature tried and succeeded in dealing with domestic violence, sexual assault. The most we can do is pass legislation defining what it is and what the penalties are. And we did the best we can, and it makes us happy to know that there's an organization that is out there to help mothers with children that are victimized. So thank you very much for your testimony.
Yes, but thank you for your time.
Okay, I'm going to go to see. There's a couple of names here. Peggy Brockman in Anchorage, are you online? Not online. How about Fred Nielsen, Dillingham? Not online. And then lastly, Francis Dingman, Unalakleet. Not online. Okay. That is all the people that I have names for. Is there anyone online that is listening that wants to testify? And anyone in the audience that wants to testify? We have one hand up, two hands up. Okay, well, the first hand up, kind of come forward. As always, put your name on the record, spelling if needed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kate Burkhart, B-U-R-K-H-A-R-T, and I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Mental Health Board. I preface my comments by saying I'm here on behalf of my board members, my board, and our constituency, and my comments are for them and no one else.
How big is your board?
We have 12 appointed members. The governor appoints our members, and we have it depends between 6 and 8 ex officio members. And our statutory responsibilities are related to issues faced by individuals who experience mental illness and the systems that serve them.
Thank you. Go ahead.
The Alaska Mental Health Board supports the passage of HB 299 because Alaska Legal Services is the legal services agency that most often represents our constituency. Conservative prevalence estimates are that about 30,000 or more households in Alaska have at least one individual who experiences mental illness, and of those, too often they live in poverty. And so the only way that they have access to justice in the civil legal system is through representation by Alaska Legal Services or another public interest law firm. One of the special qualities of Alaska Legal Services is that their attorneys have education and experience and specialized training related to those issues that most often affect individuals experiencing mental illness. You heard previously that Alaska Legal Services represents people in cases to secure Social Security benefits, supplemental security income, which is a very small monthly amount that helps people cover basic expenses like food and, we hope, housing, not often in some of our communities. Mm-hmm. That is a highly specialized area of law, and there are not very many advocates or attorneys in Alaska that practice in that area. Alaska Legal Services not only practices in that area, but has some of the most highly qualified Social Security advocates I've ever seen. And at that point, I will admit to some bias. I had the privilege to be an attorney with Alaska Legal Services for about 7 years in Nome, Juneau, and Ketchikan. And so I have direct experience working with their advocates. I also can comment to the fact that whatever area of law I took a case in, whether it was housing, Social Security, domestic violence, probate, often the family had at least one member who experienced mental illness, and often substance abuse was an issue. And so having access to services through Alaska Legal Services is very important to our constituency. It's also important that that advocacy be competent and compassionate, and Alaska Legal Services provides that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Last person.
I don't want to give anybody extra special attention.
Come on up.
My name is Marie Dolan, and I'm representing AARP, and there's no need to repeat everything you've already heard. So I just want to make a few comments, and AARP does receive many calls from older Alaskans with legal problems or questions even about, because they simply do not know where to go. And they get referred, provided they meet the low-income standards and all, to legal services by any of our representatives, because we know that they do a good job. And as Alaska's population ages, which we all know it is, the requests that we, you know, that we get, the concerns that people have, is requests for landlord-tenant disputes and other housing matters, quality health care and treatment, the public funds for whatever kinds of benefits they might have, fraud cases, and any abuse and neglect. And we know that's those requests and concerns are only going to increase with the increasing population. And actually, we just ask for your support of this, for the additional funding, because the bill would provide the additional funds to support the legal aid needs of the low-income Alaskans, including older clients, plus all that are covered by Alaska Legal Services. So therefore, we just urge your support.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Anyone else in the audience? Seeing and hearing none, I'll close public testimony. Brings it back before the committee. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Speaker, Chair, President, whatever.
Yeah, the man. Mr. Chair, I would like to move a conceptual amendment. And the amendment is to put an immediate effective date on the bill so that it can be applied if it passes to the current fiscal cycle. This is discretionary only because it says may appropriate.
Right.
and I'd like them to have the option to do it this year. So I would like to make that a conceptual amendment number one. I don't have it prepared in writing, but we've all
I think we understand it. Yeah. Is there an objection to conceptual amendment number one regarding the effective date? Seeing and hearing none, amendment number one is adopted. Brings us back to the body of Representative Holmes. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to make three hopefully quick points on the bill. The first is just to clarify that we are not actually appropriating any money in this bill. What we're simply doing is the money will still go into the general fund, but it will be sort of noted that this is funds that can be appropriated each year. We would still have to actually appropriate the money in the budget each year, so the legislature still retains control. We are not actually appropriating the money in the bill. My other two points, my second point goes very much to the comments that were made by both Monica and Michelle, and also I believe were touched on by Kate and Murray. They did an excellent job, I think, of explaining how difficult and terrifying it can be to try to navigate the legal system on your own. I'm a lawyer, and it can still be a daunting experience. You've got a lot of people out there who have things, domestic violence issues, elder abuse issues, a lot of issues out there. And to try to protect themselves without understanding the legal system can be very, very difficult and very scary. And Alaska Legal Services is the primary group out there who attempts to represent these people and help them navigate the system and help them be safe. There are consumer protection issues. There are a variety of things out there. And Alaska Legal Services does a great job. I think the director explained that they're a very low-budget operation. The attorneys are making well below market, and they're really on a shoestring budget trying to do as much good as they can. My third point is simply to give a little bit of a court system perspective. I clerked for the state Supreme Court my first job out of law school, and the courts bend over backwards to try to help citizens get fair determinations. It's really, really difficult when you have people who are trying to navigate the legal system without any help of an attorney, and they turn in paperwork that's incomplete often. They turn in paperwork that doesn't, you read it and you try to understand what it is, and what it does is it really slows down the legal process for everybody, because the court system has to spend so much time trying to figure out what it is that these people are doing. Maybe they're just trying to keep themselves safe, do restraining orders, do a child custody issue. It really, really slows down the whole process. So to have an Alaska Legal Services attorney in the case just makes everything so much more efficient. So, Mr. Chairman, I think this is a good bill. And with that, I will
make a couple comments. There are two fiscal notes that are with it, but we did have some letters of support. But I wanted to mention something about the types of cases that Legal Services handles, about 10 here. So on the record is consumer, education, employment, waiting for it to catch up, family law, juvenile, health care, housing, public benefits, individual rights, and lastly, miscellaneous. they are prohibited from handling certain types of cases, such as class actions, criminal defense, can't represent prisoners, undocumented non-citizens, with the exception if the case involves domestic violence or trafficking. And I just wanted to make sure we got at least that much on the record. One more thing. General Counsel, there is a letter in here. The court system collected and deposited into the general fund $2,666,900 in filing fees. So the bill looks like we'd have to calculate 25% of that amount. With that, I think we can conclude our public testimony here. And if you would, Representative Holmes, make a motion to pass this bill from committee.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill number 299-27-LS1272-A from committee with individual recommendations and any attached fiscal notes.
Pardon me?
We didn't amend it.
Yes,
did we?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, as amended. Thank you.
Effective date.
Yes, we did. Yes, sorry. Thank you.
As amended. Is there an objection? Seeing and hearing none, the bill advances from committee. We'll take another brief intermission to get the paperwork taken care of. House Judiciary has before it House Bill 303, Suspended Imposition of Certain Criminal Offenses. Is Annie in the room here? No.
Huh? Really? We got Rick, though.
Oh, well, we got a couple of others, don't we? And Representative Gary, you are the sponsor of this bill?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Take it on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is probably the least press-worthy bill anybody will ever see, and one that addresses a problem probably nobody's ever heard of. So let me explain it. There are certain crimes. All crimes are serious, so you know I don't want to misspeak. But there are certain crimes, lower-level crimes, where the prosecution and the defense will agree this person has no prior, and that's a requirement. Person is a good prospect for rehabilitation, and what they'll do is impose what's called a suspended imposition of sentence on this person. And they say, we'll put you on probation for 1, 2, maybe 3 years. We might even put you in jail for a little bit to scare you a little bit and let you realize the gravity of what you did. But if you complete your probation, given that you have no priors, given that the crime is of a less serious nature, we will then remove the conviction. If the judge is satisfied that you've met all the conditions, that you've done everything right, that in the interest of justice, this shouldn't be on your record anymore. We don't do anything to that law. That law is on the books. That law has been on the books forever in this state. What our bill does is sort of clarify something that lawyers debate, but that the Supreme Court has resolved in a way that I don't like. And that is, what happens when, let's say, you've engaged in a minor consuming? You've got that on your record. Judge convicts you, says you're on probation for 2 years. You don't do anything wrong. You were 19 when you had that third beer that you weren't supposed to have. Judge says you've done everything right. We've had our probation officer.
You're at Yale and you're official member of society.
Barely squeaked out of college. You're otherwise, you show good prospects for never committing another crime again. The judge has the discretion, and usually these things are done with the consent of the defense attorney and the prosecution. The judge will then remove the conviction. You don't have a conviction on your record anymore. In other states, it's called expungement. They just make it disappear from your record if you meet all those kinds of conditions. It's to give people a second lease on life. To say you made one mistake, we don't think you're going to make another one. We had you on probation for a while. You didn't do anything wrong. We don't have an expungement statute in the state, so we have no way to take that off somebody's record. We just have this thing called an SIS, which is it'll always remain on your record. You were convicted, then the conviction was removed. When I was practicing law, a client would come to me and say, look, I got my conviction removed. Can I now, when I apply for a job, when it says, have you ever been convicted, can I say I've never been convicted? I would take the position that technically you were convicted, then it was removed. I think you have to check yes that you were. Other attorneys took the position that since there is no conviction anymore, you can say that you weren't convicted. The Supreme Court ultimately came out with an opinion that said, you do have to say that you were convicted. That's the wording of the statute. What our bill does is adds one sentence to the existing law that says, if you have an SIS and your conviction is removed, you can truthfully say that you haven't been convicted because you have no conviction on your record. It's certainly something that's up to the discretion of this committee. It's not one of those issues where the answer is obvious, but the reason we brought the bill forward is because we do want to make sure that people who have done lesser crimes, where they have very good prospects for doing well, are able to get a job when they get out. I mean, the worst thing that happens is for those folks who have done things that are wrong, ranging from minor consuming to upwards of that, is to make it difficult for them to ever get a job. And you check that box that says, I have a conviction, even though your conviction was removed, you're probably not going to get called in for an interview. Now, under this bill, if it said, have you ever been arrested, you're going to have to say yes, because you were arrested. If it says, have you ever been charged, you're going to have to say yes, and you're going to have to explain that to an employer. But the part that says, have you ever been convicted, I think you should be able to say that you have not been convicted. When we filed this bill, it's been a long time since I practiced criminal law, and I did it very briefly. I was under the recollection that it only applied to really the least serious crimes. Annie Carpinetti from the Department of Law reminded me that a long time ago the SIS statute applied to actually a broader array of crimes, and the legislature has cramped them down to less serious crimes. You can't get an SIS if you've committed a crime against a person.
The term?
Oh, suspended imposition of sentence. That's the thing where they remove the conviction. You can't get that if you've had a crime against a person. You can't get it for sort of felony domestic violence or sexual crimes. But we have drafted an amendment that says this rule should really only apply if it was a misdemeanor. If the committee decides to pass that amendment, what this bill would do would say if you're convicted of a misdemeanor and the judge removes the conviction, you're able to say, I was not convicted of a crime, because there is no conviction. It doesn't exist. And it's only, the only real intention there is so that we can help people sort of get back, get into the workforce, and make them explain if they were arrested, if the employer wants to know that, why they were arrested, and they can explain that. But that's the point of the bill. There's been, like I said, debate in the legal community what the correct answer was until a recent Supreme Court opinion. There are a couple former prosecutors who are online who have had a lot more experience with this than I have who would like to testify, and I'm sure the Department of Law would like to testify. With that, I'm just ready to take questions.
Just a second. I didn't hear what you said.
Representative Grunberg just copied that and handed
it out.
We had them. So.
All right. Representative Lynn?
Did I hear you say that there's something in the law that defines a non-serious conviction? What is the legal definition of a non-serious? Yeah. It could be perhaps serious to one with a certain frame of reference and non-serious to another with a certain frame of reference.
No, I misspoke, and I did not mean to say non-serious conviction. Every crime is serious.
Yeah,
but the lesser of the crimes are the ones that the SIS law applies to. You can't, if you murdered somebody, you can't ever get an SIS. If you raped somebody, you can't ever get an SIS. You can never have that conviction removed.
I get it. Through the chair. How much less serious is less serious?
Well, that's why we've passed out our amendment to cap it at misdemeanors.
I don't have an amendment.
Aren't some misdemeanors less serious than others or more serious than others?
Sure. Sure.
How do you define that? Because we have the same misdemeanor and define it differently?
If it's a crime against a person, you're not eligible to have the conviction removed. And I'm talking about the current law. We're not changing the current law at all. So if it's a crime against a person, you can't have your conviction removed. These relate more to property crimes, to disorderly conducts, to minor consumings. I did find that some felonies were covered by this, so that's why I think it would be smarter to limit the bill that we're talking to just misdemeanors. But still, you wouldn't be eligible if it was a crime against a person. And the Department of Law can explain the full parameters of the suspended imposition of sentence law better, so you know which crimes apply, which ones don't. But I figured the committee and I would also have concerns if you were able to say you've never had a conviction if it were a felony that that most of us would regard as a more serious felony. Over the years, this SIS law has been rewritten a number of times, but I think we decided we want to cap it at misdemeanors, and only those misdemeanors where you've got no priors. The judge decides that you're a good prospect for rehab, and in most of these cases, it's where the prosecution and the defense agree, and you make it through your probation period, and then the conviction is removed from your record.
And just one final.
Go ahead.
Did we not have, at some point in your career and mine, we were in the same class, we came in at the same time, wasn't there an expungement bill of some kind that somebody had here? Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, I don't think it made it out of the legislature. Didn't we have a bill here where we discussed these issues, an expungement, using that word, actually?
I actually forget, but Representative Grunberg seems to, he just raised his hand.
You heard it, Mr. Chair. You heard it because it was Bruce Weirach, and...
That explains everything.
He read it, and his assistant worked on it. We worked on it in state affairs, I think.
That's why I remember
that. Both terms, and it was very difficult to craft, so I don't think it ever moved.
Well, I don't, because obviously it didn't become law, but I knew we had that. Apparently in my own committee, that's why I knew that.
Right.
Thank you.
Through the chair, just a...
Go ahead.
Expungement is just much more difficult because it requires that you erase stuff from the court files, and I know the prosecution has a big problem with expungement. They're probably not super thrilled about this legislation either, but you'll also hear from other members who are former prosecutors on the phone.
Representative Keller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If a person is sentenced, then that is a sure sign that the person's been convicted. You can't be sentenced without being convicted. So what you're proposing in here is that a person could lie on, in other words, if he's convicted, he's convicted, he's convicted. Is there a body of law that I'm not aware of that gives the court the power to unconvict and to expunge? In our law, in our statute?
Yes.
Through
the chair, Representative Keller, if you're convicted of a crime, this bill wouldn't apply. But this bill would only apply under a very discreet law that says the judge can remove the conviction. And when the judge removes the conviction and you have no conviction on your record, that's where this bill would apply. We don't change that law. There's a law, it's called the SIS law. You're originally convicted so the judge can put you on probation, so they can watch you for a few years, right? Then the judge says, and the prosecution says, and the defense says, usually there's an agreement between the two. I think sometimes there's not, but usually there is. They remove the conviction. You would have to apply to have the conviction removed, and if the judge says, yeah, you're, not a particularly serious crime among the levels of seriousness out there, though all crimes are serious, you've shown that you haven't reoffended, usually young people, then the judge can remove the conviction. So if that law applies, if the conviction is removed and taken off your record, then this bill would apply.
Are you referring, Representative Gary, to the law that is right for the sentence previous to this this change where it talks about set aside the conviction? So we're talking here under the umbrella of suspensions of sentence, and you used, as you explained the bill, I thought you were kind of using the term sentence kind of equivalent with conviction, and it's true in a sense. If a person is sentenced, then he is convicted. And then you're saying here that if you remove the sentence, then he can say he was never convicted. There's something, that just doesn't, it doesn't flow to me. I'm going to need some more help understanding.
Through the chair, I don't know that I can do a better job other than read that first sentence in the law. The law as it reads right now says, upon the discharge by the court without imposition of sentence, the court may set aside the conviction and issue to the person a certificate to that effect. So the conviction is set aside. It doesn't exist anymore. I'm not saying who's right. You could say, okay, that person, now that he has no conviction on his record, was never convicted. Or you can take the position, well, he was convicted and it was removed. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be an expert in that semantic game. I do believe that if it was just a misdemeanor crime, and the judge says you've met the conditions to have that conviction set aside and removed, you should, on a job application, be able to say you haven't been convicted. It's not an easy question,
Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned something earlier that kind of gave rise, as someone who's been hiring people for many years, that if I, as an employer, put down, have you been convicted, they could answer truthfully that no, because we've set it aside. But if they say, have you been arrested or have you been other things, and I started thinking about many of the people out there that are employers. I worked at one of those small coffee carts, and I'm thinking, and a lot of those are little independently owned, and that person probably doesn't have the legal knowledge to say, I got to make sure I put the right wording here to find out if the person that comes here, and maybe it was a under $500, little misdemeanor, and to them that's a big deal. They're giving this person trust of money. It almost seems like that we're leaving at a disadvantage that small business owner who would just like to know and give them and have the opportunity to make that decision for themselves what they could be possible, and if because they're using they may choose to use one word over the other, they could fall under this situation where they could find out a little bit more about the person and be prepared, or they might not. And I think that would be probably my concern with this, is it's just the legal knowledge of most people is not going to be as acute, or the legalism that they'll need to be able to understand what they may be dealing with. And I don't know if you have anything to reference to that or understand what I'm saying there, but I just thought I'd offer that up to the committee. Just my concern there.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're copying and distributing the entire AS 1255085. This is just one subsection in it. But it's a long-standing law in this state, and I assume other states, but I don't know, that a court can enter an order that's called an SIS that will allow the conviction then to be set aside. And obviously I think this may need some tweaking the language in here, but I assume first of all that you would want this amendment, the printed amendment, to be offered. Okay. Number two, it may be more comfortable to some members on the committee if, rather than saying as a matter of state law and policy, we would allow it to be discretionary with the judge. So the judge would have the power to allow somebody to state that he had not been convicted of the offense that was set aside. That may be more comfortable, or that we have something, if it gives the defendant a right, that the defendant could state that the conviction had been set aside. And I'm just offering those as possible ways of providing protection to the employer or anyone else. I mean, if you're going to marry somebody, you may want to tell them that you've been an axe murderer in your previous life, but you're pretty good now. You're an orphan, but what the heck. That your conviction had been set aside, and that might just be some creative way of still allowing a humane way of dealing with this so they don't ruin their life. But on the other hand, the people are protected. We're going to give you the whole statute here in a minute when it comes off the machine.
I'm going to exercise the privilege of the chair and set this bill aside. Let's go on to the next bill.
Mr. Chair, do you want this, since he wants the amendment in it?
You can take all the papers together.
You don't want to take
it. Set aside at the moment.
Okay.
Brings us down to committee substitute for House Bill 216, an act relating to fiscal notes for bills directing or resulting in the adoption, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Representative Wilson is on her way. The staff is ready.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, while we're waiting for the sponsor, do we need to put a CS in front
of
it?
We certainly do.
You ready for that?
I'm ready.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt CS for House Bill number 216-27-LS0701-R as our working document.
Is there an objection? Seeing and hearing none, we have committee substitute for House Bill 216, version R, before us.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Representative Holmes?
It's my understanding that this version R simply incorporates the amendments that we passed previously in this committee.
Okay.
Before anyone asks what the changes are, which is probably the next question.
Changes that we made.
The changes that we made, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. What if we want to remove them now?
Well, you, Mr. Chairman, that is within your prerogative to ask us to do that.
Yeah. I think we've been through version T, and now we're in version R, and there were the amendments that were passed.
Okay. Oops.
R is the proposed additional fixes. Yeah, there was an amendment that explains the changes, but this is offered instead of an amendment to the amendment.
Well, then maybe, Mr. Chairman, we should have somebody object so we can discuss.
Sure, object for discussion.
Okay, yes, Representative Wilson, you are here to essentially explain why we have version R in front of us, what it incorporates.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Peggy Wilson, District 2. The House Bill, just a little quick review, House Bill 216 will ensure regulations are completed and adopted in a timely manner and will ensure that all new regulations and changes to current regulations are accompanied by a brief descriptive summaries that explain those changes in plain, understandable English. Now, we're now looking at version R, which incorporates two amendments that help to clarify the bill even more, and these were things that were brought up at the last meeting. Amendment number one, that was a conceptual amendment that was brought up, and it deleted the words without cross-referencing the Alaska Administrative Code. And it was passed at the last meeting, and you'll find that change on page 2, lines 13 through 15.
Find an empty space there?
Yep.
Got it?
Okay. All right. And then amendment number 2 suggested that by the Attorney General's office addressed three issues. In the first part, under subsection F on page 1, lines 9 through and 10, clarifies that it is the department or agencies, not the legislature, that sets the deadline for completing and adopting regulations or changes. And it reads, the department affected shall include in the fiscal note for the bill a specific time by which the agency shall adopt, amend, or repeal the regulation. That just clarifies that. The second part clarifies the double negative language in subsection D on page 2, lines 2 through 5. And you will find a much clearer language about which boards and commissions are and are not exempt from the requirements of the subsection F. So that explains it, and it's much clearer now. And these were suggestions that had been made before.
Okay, and is there anything else that's been added to this CS besides the two amendments?
No.
An effective date.
You sure?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry, there is. There is an effective date.
Be advised that you are sworn.
The third, we have added an effective date to the end of the bill on page 2, line 24. And this is a new section to read. Section 4, and that is so that the departments don't have to do it in the middle of a session, so that we give them time to think about this, and so at the beginning of our new fiscal year is when it would start.
Okay. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is possible that if this passes, it wouldn't take effect until later. 90 days may be past July 1st of this year. So this would actually be retroactive and may be an additional burden on the agency if you use this particular date. And I don't want to say anything, but the bill's got a ways to go, and I would ask the sponsor if she'd talk to the agencies or her staff to make sure that this really is the right date, because I think this may actually make it tougher on the agency.
Okay, yeah, we don't want to do that.
But if this thing passes, goes all the way, and we're out of here in April, you're saying that's insufficient time between April 18th and July
1st? It won't be signed on April 18th.
No.
And then they have 90 days after it's signed. I would think that the effective, it may not even, it's conceivable it won't be signed until after July 1st. Probably will, but it wouldn't give the agencies possibly enough time. I would just ask you to check. I don't have an answer.
And I will check.
Do you want to make an amendment?
No.
No amendments. Okay. Just check. Well, if we're going to check and then come back here, then we need to set this aside.
No amendment?
Well, I don't know. I think you probably want to move it, don't you?
Yeah, I would like to move it.
I'm not surprised at that. But if we're waiting for a change, then we should make sure we've done all we can on the bill.
I think on something like that, even if we do it on the floor, just a date.
Yeah.
I don't think so. So we'll hold it, and don't tell me no.
I hope we can move it.
I know you do, but we're going to hold it until we get the change. Okay? Brings us down to the last bill, 296.
Here
are the amendments.
Who is that? 296 culprit.
This is House Judiciary.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I didn't mean to cause a problem.
House Judiciary Bill.
296.
Oh.
Thank you.
So, Representative Gruenberg, you are going to speak to 296?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
There were several things that we were considering doing. We were considering doing a purposes section, that it was the intent to clarify bridges, the escape bill. We decided not to do that. We normally don't do that. I think it's clear on the record that's one of the stuff we're doing. We were going to have a reference discuss whether to deal with good time. In this, that became very complicated. Mr. Bridge wouldn't be entitled to good time anyway because he'd never been convicted of anything. And the other thing we were going to do related to Sections 3 and 4. Section 4 would change the general definition of escape throughout the criminal code. That would have huge ramifications. And Ms. Carpinetti said at the last hearing she needed time to research, and we decided to delete Section 4. And then Section 3 was the area that law and corrections were going to discuss, and they did. They took, what do we have, maybe 10 days between the time we looked at it, or at least a week, and they came up with the language. And both of those are in the amendment. It's D4, which I would ask to be labeled amendment number 1, and that's to the D version of the bill. I'm sorry, that's to the... Yeah,
D.4?
Oh, that's amendment number 2, apparently, Mr. Chairman.
Well, it's going to be amendment number 2. Okay, this is amendment number 2.
I trust Susan on these
matters. It's D4 in the upper right-hand corner. And as you can see, it does two things on line 13 of the amendment. It deletes Section 4 of the bill, and on line 5 of the amendment, it has a new definition in Section 3 in place of the current language on lines 10 to 18. And it's easier to apply, and it follows bridges. And once again, we're codifying bridges, so we don't have more of these cases. That is going to be easy to apply. And I would move amendment number two.
Mr. Chairman, I'll object.
Amendment number 2, labeled D.4, is objected to by Representative Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, my reason for the objection is I just, do we have anybody from Law or Corrections who could just verify?
No, I'm repeating what they've said.
They're still online.
Oh, they're still online, apparently.
Oh, good.
Good, because I have...
At least we have...
Okay. Here we go. Quinlan Steiner, are you online?
No, he's not.
This is Quinlan Steiner with the Public Defender Agency. I haven't had a chance to review the amendments, so I can't comment on them. I was going to make myself available for questions, but I would like to at some point look at that new definition.
Okay, thanks very much. Rick Allen, are you online?
He's OPA.
Yeah, I don't think either one of them.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am, and I also just wanted to be available for questions. Thank you.
There we go.
Can we get any?
If I could add to the question, I'm sorry if I have waited longer than I should have to ask this, but I'm a little slow, putting it together with another bill that I have, and it's going to take me just a little bit to explain it. As I understand it, if a person is in a correctional facility, a person who is qualified for Medicaid gets put into a correctional facility. When he's in the correctional facility in the state of Alaska, the state then picks up the cost that would otherwise be billed to the Medicaid, to Medicaid. It's a state GF expenditure. Okay. The problem that if we're going to keep the bill and look at this definition change that you may or may not have considered is whether the change in the definition of a correctional facility makes it so it has ramifications on the amount of Medicaid funds available to reimburse the state for, let me finish, for the care that would otherwise be covered by Medicaid. Because what's happened is there's been some changes the way Medicaid handles people that are in correctional facilities that are qualified. If they are in a institution that is not a correctional facility, then they do qualify now for Medicaid, and the federal government does pay for the health care. And there's some confusion, with our regulations, with the change in the way the feds have approached this, and they aren't answered. In fact, I haven't asked for a hearing on my bill because we're trying to answer it for the general population. So what I'm worried about is that when we're talking about the definition of a correctional facility, that there may be ramifications that we haven't seen yet, and I don't understand for sure.
Mr. Chair, may I answer that?
Representative Grunberg.
There might have been had we not eliminated Section 4. All this does is change the definition in the escape statute. Escape in the second degree. And the only question is AS 11.56.310 is escape in the second degree. And the only thing it does is it says to be convicted, to be charged with escape in the second degree, you have to be in a secure facility, a secure correctional facility. And this simply defines it. It codifies the Bridges case. And if it's not a secure correctional facility, then it would be escape in the fourth degree. It doesn't have anything to do with Medicaid.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, that is a good explanation, and I am satisfied with it.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I contacted the Legislative Liaison, and she's looking for someone to call in.
Okay.
Or come in.
Do you want to stand at ease for a minute?
Well, we can go on at ease, intermission, and break simultaneously. So we'll go off the record, please. Judiciary, back to order here. Doug Gardner, you on the line?
Yeah, he's on the line.
I can't hear him. I need a yes. Doug Gardner?
Yes, Chairman Gatto, I am here.
Thank you. Was there a question from the committee? Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question was,
I assume Mr. Gardner knows we're talking about House Bill 296, and we're talking about Amendment Number 2, which was D.4, which I believe Mr. Gardner drafted. And the question was, when the amendment sponsor, Representative Grunberg, was presenting the amendment, he was talking about how this was in relation to some concerns from the Department of Law and the Department of Corrections the last time the bill was heard about the definition of secure correctional facility and correctional facility. Representative Grunberg mentioned that this amendment had been drafted in coordination with those departments. Since the departments are not actually sitting in the room right now, before we pass the amendment, I just kind of wanted to do our due diligence as a committee. Representative Grunberg indicated that you, Mr. Gardner, had spoken with the departments and worked with them and maybe could help walk us through this amendment and make us feel good about passing it out. It's kind of a long way of saying, can you tell us what this does and doesn't do and that it was Department of Law and Department of Corrections worked on you with it?
Okay. Mr. Director, did you get all of that?
I did get all of that. Through the chair, my name is Doug Gardner, Director of Legal Services, Representative Holmes, through the chair. Chairman Gatto, one thing I haven't had a chance to do is speak with Representative Grunberg this morning. I believe he was on the floor when these amendments were requested, and I haven't had a chance to speak with him about the amendments, so I'm assuming Mr. Representative Grunberg wants me to just respond candidly to Representative Holmes' comments.
Representative Grunberg?
Mr. Chair, yes, I was informed that we received communications from them in writing that this was their language, and Miles Brook, my assistant, you've also had communications with them, have you not? Yeah, he could come up and testify also about this.
I think, Mr. Chairman, I think that Mr. Gardner is just asking Representative Grunberg to waive attorney-client privilege in discussing this, and again, give Mr. Gardner permission to actually speak candidly with the committee about the amendment, since you're the one who requested it.
I'm sorry, this is too secret. No, please, I waive any confidentiality. I didn't realize that was what was going on here. Yes, sure.
All right.
Doug, talk.
My counsel, Representative Holmes, did a better job than I did in summarizing the situation.
It's a team sport.
Your staff can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding was that these were changes that the Department of Law wanted, and the timing of them coming over here was such that I think we barely got them into committee. I have some comments that I would make about them if that's helpful to the committee, but I did not get a chance to sit down and work with the Department of Law carefully on them, Representative Grunberg.
Okay. Please go ahead. You have my permission. Answer the members' questions.
Representative Taylor has a question before we go on.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. This is Representative Keller. I want confirmation, clear and precise, that this will not affect the definition in any way, other parts of the statute. Representative Grunberg has responded that the change that was made to the definition of secure correctional facility here has no ramifications elsewhere. My concern had to do with the definition that related to Medicaid applications, and there's a cost factor involved. And So he assured me, to my satisfaction, that this was limited to the escape section of the law here in which we're dealing, and it does not. There's no ramifications outside of that. Am I understanding you right?
I believe that Representative Grunberg's accurate. Through Chair Representative Keller, I believe that Representative Grunberg's right, that the definition of secure correctional facility relates to just this section, just the section involving the escape statutes, and so I don't believe it has a broader application.
Well, thank you for putting that on the record, and I'm sure, I'll look very carefully, and I'm sure the sponsor will too. Yeah. Thank you.
I would just say one last thing. I'm not extremely familiar with Medicaid, and if there's another use of this term in Medicaid, I'm not aware of it sitting here right now.
Okay. Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I heard Mr. Gardner say he had a couple of additional comments, and I was
I'd like to hear them too. Let's hear a couple of additional comments, and we'll be at the end of the bill if we can get that far.
Well, Representative Holmes, through the chair, these are pretty much the proposed changes that the Department of Law wanted to have put into a amendment. I drafted them Representative Gruenberg's staff, and I think barely made it over for the meeting shortly before one. I'm a little bit, I guess, the definition that was previously in the bill, secure correctional facility, I think was perhaps a little tighter than the definition when it comes to part two of the definition of correctional facility, where it says employs correctional officers or other facility staff charged with preventing persons from essentially from departing from the facility. The proposed amendment D4 has correctional officers or other persons, and cautious in a criminal statute about other persons. Other persons is pretty broad. You know, it may be that doesn't present a problem down the road, but the prior draft nails down that we're talking about employees, correctional officers, or other facility staff. So perhaps a passing police officer or some other person. I mean, they have to be authorized, and I get that, and I understand I'm being a little picky, but I think the prior definition had some advantages because it was limited, and so I was concerned about that when I drafted it, and that's why I had not had a chance to apprise Representative Gruenberg of that concern, and so I just point that out for the committee's benefit. The other removal of the changes to the definition of correctional facility, I have spoken with Representative Gruenberg about, and I'm assuming that there's been some discussion about that already, and I can respond to that if you want me to.
I think that's a good idea while we have you online.
I understand that this D4 would delete the definition of definition of correctional facility in 1181-900-B9. It would take out the rest of the proposed definition. And one of the concerns that could be raised by this is that there may be some competing definitions of correctional facility based on the court's ruling in Bridge versus State 258 P3rd 923, where the court in Bridge did not appear to focus on the persons under official detention portion of the definition, but instead seemed to focus on the idea of confinement. And interpreted correctional facility for purposes of the escape statute fairly narrowly in what I would describe as a correctional facility needing to have sort of a barbed wire and fence and more of what I think is considered to be a traditional jail. My understanding of the definition of correctional facility is not only is it a it's an official detention definition, which I think is broader, arguably, than what the Court of Appeals came to by saying a correctional facility is a place where prisoners are forcibly maintained by a correction officer or other guards. And so I wanted just to call to the committee's attention the idea that there may be some competing definitions there. The one in the case versus the one that is broader, arguably, in 1181-900-B9, and I just point that out for the committee's benefit.
Representative Gruenberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's exactly the reason they took it out, because they don't want to affect anything else, and it may be slightly different for other areas of the law, but this is to be narrowly, laser-like, focused on the Bridge case, and that result, because that was the only issue that was before that court. Otherwise, we're going to get away, and it'll be a slippery slope. So this is only the definition for escape in the second degree.
Okay, Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't mean to belabor this, but Doug, if you could help me out. Right now, the way this reads without the bill, is it true that you could argue that we're talking here about a group home, a house, you know, some kind of a holding facility, you know, halfway house, camp? And what's unclear to me, I'm not saying this is the case, but what's unclear to me is that if I understand it right, I explained this before you were listening, maybe you heard of it, the federal government pays Medicaid expenditures for somebody that is eligible when they are becoming into a facility, if they're qualified, and they didn't used to do that. And the point is that, like, if somebody is in a regular correctional facility, a lockdown, secure, if they take that person out of the secure facility, bring them to the local hospital and contract with the hospital, then now the federal government will pay under Medicaid. And what I'm nervous about, you know, is that we're trying to correct that, you know, because our state has regulations that prevent Medicaid from paying. I'm worried about the confusion here. That's all. And maybe you can help me. I thought I understood and I thought I was satisfied by the sponsor's statement, but now I'm wondering, you know, if this section of law, without your changes, can be interpreted as a group home, house, some other facility, and not a correctional facility. You see the problem? It's possible that there could be federal money that we're losing.
If I may say something, then Mr. Gardner may want to say something first. I'm not entirely sure I totally understand what you said, but I would say, if you have somebody who is in prison and they have to be taken to a civilian hospital, I presume they are under security at the time, either in a locked ward or with a guard outside. So they would be in a secure correctional facility at that point, the way I read Amendment B4. And maybe Mr. Gardner would want to say something, or you can ask him, Representative Keller. Mr. Gardner?
Through the Chair, Representatives Keller and Grunberg, first of all, I don't have an intimate familiarity with Medicaid, and I have to say that I didn't anticipate that question for today's hearing. I would say that there is a definition of correctional facility in Title 33 as well. The definition in 1181-900 that we are discussing right now, generally speaking, I think is a fairly limited application to criminal statutes and may not necessarily be the definition that is the focus of Medicaid. Having said that, correctional facility right now, as it reads, Alaska law would mean a premises or portion of premises used for housing persons under official detention. And I believe that official detention would probably cover a situation where somebody is in the custody of the department and they're placed somewhere. For purposes of the escape statute, clearly, under the Bridge case, a fairly loose placement without a locked door or something like that probably wouldn't constitute an escape the way that the court in Bridge interpreted the law. But for purposes of Medicaid, I don't think that the same interpretation would necessarily be given to 1181-900. And I think I'm agreeing with what Representative Grunberg said, that a correctional facility would still mean a premises or portion of a premises for the confinement of persons under official detention. And I think that the argument could still be made that while it might not constitute an escape, it would be a placement for purposes of confinement of persons under official detention. Again, I don't know how Medicaid works, but I think this is a fairly narrow definition that applies to the escape statutes more specifically.
One more?
Thank you. I want to clarify that I have asked for clarification from Health and Civil Services, and that is pending. So if I confuse the question a bit, I apologize. But if it's okay, I would like to request the Chair to keep the
Bill Fernow and we'll continue to work on this unless, you know.
Let me just ask, certainly it's up to the chair. Would you be able to get an answer so we could take it up early next week? Because it's been here for.
I have not gotten the. I did not put a deadline on the answer that I was getting from the department. It has to do with, I believe it's House Bill 288 that I have to try to straighten this out. So,
Mr. Chair, could we at least take up the amendment so that we know the amendments in the proposed CS? No, you don't want to do that.
I think what I'd like to do is set it aside for next week. And unless there's an objection to that, I'm going to adjourn. We're adjourned.